afternoon, friends and listeners. Thanks for joining me this Saturday afternoon for my special 3-year anniversary show, which also I have realized just today, I think, that it turned out to be a 10-year anniversary of my entry into the truth movement. So I thought I'd talk about that too. This subject of my 3 years on the with my website CarolynJaeger.net has turned into a show, and in doing that, I forgot to make a post out of it, which I usually did for the first and second year. So I'll have to do that. I'll have to do that afterwards. Totally slipped my mind since I was working on the program. It is, of course, on the program post. So anyway, this is just sort of came about that this Saturday, when I generally have a program, fell on September 27th, which is the date in 2011 that my website first, at least since the Globe started counting visitors to my new website. I'm talking about CarolynJaeger.net, and before that I had CarolynJaeger.com, and I had Carolyn Jaeger Writings. Before that I had WhiteWomenOnly.com, and it was also had a theme of white warrior woman or women, I don't even remember which. When that started in 2007. But 3 years ago, Bill Fink had created a website for me, and just to see if I would like it. And I realized I had been very satisfied with just my own, what I had made up of my own and the way I was doing it, which was difficult, you know, but time consuming. But I didn't have a problem with that at the time. And I was loath to kind of turn it into something that looked like other people's websites. But when I saw what he had, and I was finally learning that that these programs like WordPress, for example, are very flexible, and they're the best way to go if you're going to create a website. And he created one with using Drupal, which is what he uses. And I thought, well, that looks real good. I was real happy. He helped me move. He did most of it. Moved all my content over from my other website and left that up for a little while. But I finally shut that down. And I've been real, real happy with this website, which I did call CarolynJaeger.com in the beginning, but then switched it. I had both. I don't even remember now exactly why, what the problem was, but finally switched it to CarolynJaeger.net. I do still have both domain names, but so it doesn't really matter. But I like people to use CarolynJaeger.net because they're seen as two different. Well, I don't know if they still are. They were seen as two different domains in the beginning for a while, and that's why I had I was listed like on Alexa in under both names, and so my visitor count was divided between those two names. So anyway, all that got straightened out, and I want to say I'm making a whole show out of this because it's not going to be the whole show, but I'm making a show out of it because I really have had great success in this 3 years that I've been really seriously working on this website. And and from the beginning, Bill set it up so that it would include my radio programs, which were underway at that time. Yeah, because I started radio in 2010, and this didn't go up until September 2011. So that was a new thing that I hadn't had on my website, my earlier websites. I just had to link to to Voice of Reason at that time and, you know, recommend people to go there and listen to my programs. So I have a pretty comprehensive site now, which includes everything that I've done and that I do. And it's under good management. And it will continue, and even if I'm not able to continue working on it, hopefully it will continue at least for quite a while after, you know, on into the future as a repository of my efforts. So, but I'm happy to say that I've had, when I say I've had great success, well, of course I'm not in the upper few percent of websites or anything like that, but I can say that before I turn to my own server stats traffic, I'll say that I'm at Alexa, I have come back under the 200,000 number of, therefore, the under the 200,000 most popular websites in the world, according to them. And there's, I guess, the millions. I don't know, a million or millions. I don't know how many, but plenty. So that's a pretty good number. I think it's 197,000 now. And I had been down even to 180,000. And then suddenly Alexa started moving me into a higher number again. And I really messed up a lot of things there. I was really down on Alexa, but they've straightened a lot of that out now. So they've got me at 44,000 at most popular website in the United States, which is not bad considering. I think it's pretty good considering where I see a lot of my, what people would, excuse me, think of as contemporaries, and if not competitors, maybe not competitors, but similar type of site, and not even similar because I'm a solo person. I'm not a network, and except for having my own shows. I don't represent other people. I don't represent a number of radio programs, just my own programs. And I'm still ahead of these others who do that, who do have a network and have a number of hosts and so on. So I want to thank, first, I certainly want to thank all the people who have been coming to my website and the new people and the increasing numbers that come. Instead of, you know, I'll just go through it here. I don't quite know where to start here. All right, I have more traffic today than I had in May, right after the White Network went out of business. And I have, that happened in April of this year. And then I, as everybody knows who was involved in that, I redirected, it was my domain name, thewhitenetwork.com, and I redirected the traffic to my website. So I was getting a lot of traffic then. I'm on my server stats now, so I think I'll start here. It jumped up and I started, my Alexa ranking started coming down and kept coming down. But, you know, that came to an end. That kind of traffic came to an end. And then I continued to have more visitors every month. And I now I'm still having more visitors every month. And it has nothing to do with, it does have a lot to do with the fact that I'm only available at CarolynJaeger.net. Because before, so much of what I did was available, was at the White Network, and I was becoming more and more associated in people's minds as Carolyn Jaeger at the White Network. You know, that's where they went. And once they couldn't go there, once they didn't find me there anymore, and they got used to, first there was a lot of people searching, but that stopped because link doesn't, I don't know, it doesn't do the same thing as it did. So, but people now know where they have to come to find out anything about me, and so they're coming to CarolynJaeger.net. And in that sense, it's taken away a good website from all those people out, all you people out there. But it has given my personal website a big boost. So it hasn't worked out badly for me. And I will say that according to my own server, in January 2014 of this year, I had 11,734 unique visitors and 20,000 and a half visits. And then in February, it went up to 14. Now, I've always found that the first part of the year is the best, and it builds up to May and June. Sometimes I've usually found that May is the best month of all. And then it goes down in the summer and it goes down some and starts to pick up a little bit in the fall. But it really, really makes its big increases. And the more people are active, I would say, on the internet in the spring. And in the spring. And particularly March, April, May. But what I've got here is that on, like I said, in January it was 11,000, almost 12,000, and then went up to 14,600 in February. March went up again, 15,800. Then April, this is a single visitors, unique visitors, unique, well, every different, everyone different, not visits. And in April, went up again quite a bit to almost 20,000. From almost 16,000, almost 20,000. And in May, it went up again, 5,000 more to 24,600. And in June, it did go down a little to 22,000. In July, 23,000 is what you'd expect. And in August, 22, and in September, 22. So I'm holding at, 22, almost 23, closer to 23,000 unique visitors a month, even though May was the high point. I'm looking at my current period here, okay. And but the number of visits has increased every month, even from May, June, July. Starting at 20,000 in January, and then hitting a high of 55,141 in May, which could have been due to the White Network redirect. But in June, 52,000. But then in July, 58,000. In August, 63,000. And in September, 65,000. So my number of visits has continued to increase. And I'm not trying to say these are huge numbers for a lot of sites that have much higher numbers than this, but they're very different kind of sites than mine. So I'm not trying to compare, or I'm not even trying to brag. I'm happy though. I'm just trying to point out how I'm doing, I guess, you know, I mean, how I feel about it and how people out there feel about it. You know, I have a pretty limited repertoire of thinking, and I'm going to go to my site here and topics on my at CarolynJaeger.net. So it's not like I would attract a whole lot of varied people. But I seem to have loyal people and people who keep coming back and are regulars here, and I keep getting new people. So let me point out that at my site, according to the Globe, now this Globe was put on in the beginning, but I don't know if it was there from the very first day, but that doesn't matter. Right now, it keeps track of every visitor to my site and gives me lots of statistics, which are easier to follow in a way, better presented than my server does. And it's accumulated. On my server, it's month by month. So what I have is is each month, you know, set on a separate page, and things like that. So, but on this globe, which I think is available for everybody to look at, I think so. You just click on the globe and you go to these all this stuff. And I was studying up on this morning. This morning, when I stopped, I had a little over 393 visits in this since I started, since September 27th, 2011. Right now, it's 393. That's not much more, you know, a couple hundred more. So, or if that. So, you know, it takes a long time. It takes a lot of visits to a lot of hits. And this isn't page views, this number. This is just separate visits, but not individual visitors, just visits. It takes a lot to add up to a number like that. I was thinking about that number. Say, I'm moving toward 400,000. When you think of... I was thinking about the Holocaust and 6 million. You know, I'm thinking about the numbers that they come up with of how many people were murdered and burned up and buried and so on in the time that, you know, that they give. And they have no problem coming up with these huge numbers. And I started thinking about what it takes to make up 400,000 visits, or 400, this is visits, not people, but 400,000 over, even though it's a steady people coming all the time. There's more people that come steadily in the last few months than I used to have coming steadily. You know, more lighting up on my globe than I used to have, except at certain times. But but really, you know, you think all that goes on and on all these years, and it only adds up to 400,000, not quite that yet. My gosh, what a huge number that is. And yet it's nothing in the Holocaust business, you know, believers. Oh, 400,000 here, 500,000 there, 900,000 somewhere else, all like thousands and thousands all over the place to add up to the number that they want to add up to. 6 million. How long? I think I may have 1 million page views, considering what I've looked at. I'm not sure, but I could very likely, or maybe more than that, page views. If I could give the page view number, it would be pretty good. But I couldn't find it. But what I did find, what I did want to discuss about it, is that looking at the breakdown is what you would pretty much expect. I mostly just ever paid attention to the breakdown of countries. But I've got more breakdown here today just for the interest of it. You know, I don't spend time studying stats for my site. If I do get into it, I find it, so I've gotten real involved in it, but then I forget about it, and I don't go back to it for a long time. So I'm not somebody who follows all that. I certainly don't follow it closely, but I do follow the countries, and I'll start with that. Naturally, this is an English language site completely, so naturally the, and then you have more visitors depending on the size of the country. A big country like the United States is likely to be on top, but even so, since I live in the United States and I appeal to my fellow Americans quite a bit in the things that I write and put on my site, it's natural, but it stayed very steady. It's usually been a little over 53%, but it's just now, last couple of days, gone down below 53%. It's at 52.99% from the United States, and a little over 10% from the United Kingdom. That's number two. Number three is Canada. Not surprising. That's at 6.3% of my visitors. Germany is number four, and that makes me very happy because I write a lot about Germany, but I write it in English. But I'm glad that And I think that number's gone up, too. It slowly inches up, and that pleases me. So that is 4.89% from Germany right now. And then the next number five is Australia at 3.29. So Germany's a fairly good-sized country, but not that big. And so that shows that that there are Germans there who are following my website. And Germany is in between Canada and Australia. Those four, U.S., U.K., Canada, Australia, are all English-speaking. Germany's the only one up there that is not English-speaking. Although, I will say, you can go to Germany without knowing any German, and particularly in the western part, you can get along just fine. And everybody can talk to you. It's pretty amazing. So they're quite knowledgeable when it comes to, or quite good when it comes to speaking English. So number six is Sweden, and Sweden is pretty good on a lot of people's websites. Sweden's the people in Sweden follow a lot of American sites and networks and so on. And they are at, but they're down quite a bit from Australia. Australia, I said, was 3.29%. Sweden is 1.78%. After that, Finland, 1.58%. And then the Netherlands, 1.46%. And then France at 1.40%. And number 10 is Belgium. I think it was a 1.3 something. That's the top 10. It goes all the way down. I have 201 countries have at least one person, one visit from 210 countries here at my site. The last 20 or so of them have just one visit, and they go from American Samoa to Vanuatu. I never heard of that country. Vanuatu. I don't even know where it is. It's got a flag, though. That's that part. Now, going on to the states in the United States that are my biggest visitors, and once again, naturally, it would be the biggest states. The states with the greatest population are far more likely to be, you know, have more people come to see your site. So, and that's the way it works out, except for Louisiana stuck in there. I have a lot of fans from Louisiana, so thank you, friends from there. Of course, number one is California at 13%. Number two is Texas at 10%. Number three, New York at 6.6. Number four, Louisiana, 6.4. And after that, Florida is number five at 4.6. Now, Florida is a pretty big state. We know it has a lot of electoral votes. You know that's from the if you follow political federal presidential elections, which states are the ones that are most, you know, desirable to win and necessary to win, and Florida is one of them. I don't think Louisiana is, but there it is. Boy, I know there's somebody from Hessemer, Louisiana, that shows up a lot. I say hello to him. Maybe there's more than just him. Maybe a bunch of them there in Hessemer. Now, number six, as far as states go, is Washington. And that's not Washington, D.C. That's Washington State, which is kind of surprising, too, although they've got Seattle and, Seattle there. But I'm happy that I have quite a few there. But that percentage is 4.5%. from Washington State. And then Illinois, my old home state, is a big state too, a large population. That's at 4.49, almost 4.5. And Pennsylvania, another large population state, 3.6. And number nine is New Jersey, another big one at 3.5. And number 10 got lost. I don't know where that went. So then I thought, well, I'll look at the United Kingdom, because they're my number two visitors as far as nations go, and I appreciate them very much. And that, of course, number one is London, the big population center, is 16.2% of my UK visitors come from London. In second place is Enfield, which is 15%, right under London. And Enfield is, close, is in that same area. And number three is Birmingham, home of Paul Hickman. It's at five. It goes way down, though. It goes 5.48%. So, you know, the London and Enfield are 16 and 15%, and then we lose 10, it goes down 10 points. But that's got to be a large part. The size of, you know, the population. So number four is Manchester at 4.4, and five is Hertford, they probably say, at 3.4. Number six is one of those things where people avoid giving where they're from, and that's a little over 3%. Then number seven is Leeds, at a little over 3%. Number eight, Liverpool at 2.8. Number nine, Warrington, 2.61. And the 10th is the city of Edinburgh in Scotland. So there you go. That's a little under low 2% range. And so I looked at Canada too, and I just have seven provinces from Canada because there are not that many there. They're large, you know, and naturally the first place is Ontario, where over 54% of my Canadian visitors come from Ontario. It doesn't really surprise me. Number two place is British Columbia. On the other end of Canada, of the continent, there is 14%. Goes way down from 54% to 14%. Quebec brings 12%, Alberta, number four, Alberta, 8%, five is Manitoba at 2.95%, almost 3%, and Nova Scotia at 2.57%, which adds up to 637 people from Nova Scotia. I've had visits from Nova Scotia in 3 years. Not a lot, but anyway, there's some people coming. And then number seven is Saskatchewan. But for some reason, the last numbers didn't copy. So I don't have them, but I think it was a one point something. But I'm not sorry if I'm not too popular in Saskatchewan, because I have quite a few bunch of relatives, family living there that I don't think they would appreciate my website very much if they saw it. And I don't think I keep in touch with one of them there, and she's never said anything, but she doesn't have a computer herself. But I don't think they know anything about me there in Saskatchewan, and they carry that name, you know. There's a lot of them. Well, you know, I mean, relatively a lot. Okay, so that's Canada. And so then I thought, well, I'm going to look at Germany too, because I like Germany so much. So this is the last one I'm going to give you folks, hope you're not getting bored with this. I'm not trying to blow my horn here, but I just think it's kind of interesting. I'm sure it's very similar with me to many, many sites like mine, or somewhat like mine, that where the people are coming from. And but for my site, the number one state the number one state in Germany of my visitors is Baden-Württemberg, which, if you followed my recent posts and programs, that's my ancestral homeland, particularly Baden. So Baden-Württemberg people are showing up the most from Germany. And it is the third largest state, but not the first largest. And that's at 22.4% of the visits from Germany, and number two is Bavaria, 18.7%. And that, you know, those two are the southern states, and I believe that those states were and still are most friendly to National Socialism. So I'm not surprised that, except for, well, I'm not so sure about some of these others. I don't really know, because in the entire population, you know, might not. I don't know how the whole population works out. I'd like to study a lot more about Germany, not only the geography, which I'm really challenged on geography. I'm getting better. But also the nature of these states. I had no clear idea of the states in the north, what was where and what they were. But I've been looking at that, so I have a better idea now. So there we have it's Nordrhein-Westfalen. So it's a different name in English, but anyway, I forgot. I had it this morning, but now I've forgotten it. North something. Westphalen maybe is what it's called. Anyway, that goes down to 14%. The others were 22 and 18, now this is 14. And then another one of these where you don't have to say where you're from, that's 8%. And number five is Berlin at 7.5%. Number six, Niedersachsen or Lower Saxony, Lower Saxony at 6.68, and Hessen or Hesse at 6.17, which is above, Hesse is above Baden-Württemberg. And then Saxon, which is where Dresden is, or Saxony, is at almost 4%, and Schleswig-Holstein is at 2.62%. And Rhineland-Pfalz, that's where Gunter Deckert is from. And he calls it the Palatinate. That's 2.52%. You know, that's a pretty active state, I think, and yet it's pretty low here on my list. And it may be that he's in a kind of unfriendly territory there, Gunter is. It's not as friendly as Baden-Württemberg in Bavaria. So, in Nordrhein-Westfalen, if I didn't pronounce that right, I didn't make sure. I have to make sure of all these things before I get started, and I don't always do that. I look it up, and then I don't have a clear idea of it by the time I start the show. In any case, that's what I was looking at this morning, and I guess that's all I have to say about my website traffic, except that I do try to keep new things up and to put things up that will keep people coming to look, so that they don't get bored and forget all about me, forget all about my site, because I think that my message is one that I want to get out there. I really want to get my message out. And I'm going to talk about that now a little bit. I'm going to go to, let's see if there's anything else I wanted to cover. Well, if there is, I'm going to close this site. All right. I decided to go next to a website that I maintain, which is January27.org, because there's a need to start working for this coming January 27th, and I'm going to go there right now. I shouldn't have closed that other page, but well. Okay, takes a second here. There it is. This website was given attention last January 27th and before and after, and it first appeared. So this coming January will be the second anniversary of it. And this is a website that I undertook, but with help and agreement with a number of revisionists. But I will have to, you know, it's up to me. I pay for this. It's got its own little server. I didn't want to put it on a server with something else because I thought it might attract a lot of angry, you know, trouble from the Holocausters, and so I didn't want to give trouble to these other sites because of it. So I bought a small little server, although it costs $21 a month, every month for this, to keep this online. But I think if you want to go there, it's just jan27.org, real simple. And I've got a globe there too, and wonder if anybody shows up here while I'm talking about it, because it doesn't get much traffic at all, and I'm not surprised. Yeah, somebody from out there and on the West Coast just came over here to January27.org. Now, it doesn't get, I'm not surprised because it's a static site. It's a wonderful site, I think. I was just looking it over. I don't come very often to hear myself because I'm so busy and I'm not thinking about this. And as a matter of fact, I have to apologize to J.A., who I came over here this morning and, you know, logged in and here was a couple of comments that, and they're from September 10th, so at least it wasn't from August or July. And I have been here since then. But this J.A. wrote a couple of comments on, as I said, September 10th, and I just saw him today and approved them. He probably was wondering why his comment didn't go up. Well, that's why, because this site is a bit, not a lot of attention is paid because it just sits here and I have to. But from now on until this next January, where the next big event is going to take place, oh, now there's quite a number of people lighting up the globe here. Isn't that nice? Then I'm going to be coming here regularly and checking things and keeping up with it and making some additions and so on. And there's a number of reasons I'm talking about this today. There was I read something on Robert Forison's website, his blog. He has a blog which somebody else pretty much maintains for him, but he gives permission or not for whatever goes up there, and he's got some new things up there, and I read one yesterday or the day before, I think it's just yesterday, and I was so impressed with it and so angry. It made me so angry, and I just, you know how you get with this Holocaust stuff and these Jews, the way they deal with it. So I thought, wow, you know, I'm going to talk about that tomorrow, and I'm also going to talk about this website again because it's coming up, and I've been thinking, well, I've got to start putting my attention on it because January is going to be here before you know it. In fact, it's almost October, and there's always a lot of other things to do. I'm sorry, I'm chatting away here unnecessarily. So, you know, one has to get on things. So I want you to know that next January is going to be the 70th anniversary of this United Nations created day of commemoration. The one that we did this past January was the 69th. And so they didn't make as big of a deal of it, even though the whole a large part of the Israeli parliament or whatever they call their legislative body there came as a delegation, and that was kind of the highlight of it. Elie Wiesel was announced to going to be there, and then he didn't show up, So I bet though they'll get him there for this 70th one. If he does, if not, I don't really care. But I just think they will, and they'll make a lot out of it, as they always do for anniversaries that end in zero. So we'll have to be prepared for that also. And I want to let's see. I have had comments as to why is the name of this so long? Why, you know, the title of the site, but also the name of this, what we're calling this, is so long. People can't follow it. It should be shortened. Well, I want to tell you why it's so long. Well, first I'm going to tell you what the UN commemoration day is. See, they always give long names themselves. So it's natural that ours, which is for the revisionists, commemorating the revisionists, would be long too, but ours is longer. Theirs is the International Day of Commemoration in memory of the victims of the Holocaust. Now, they do that because they want to include the whole Holocaust, but this commemoration day is actually on January 27th because it's the so-called liberation of Auschwitz-Birkenau. And the other thing is that they only have an event going on, a big event going on at Auschwitz-Birkenau Memorial, not anywhere else, and except for United Nations building in New York City. So I named this, and I did it with the help of Bradley Smith, who I consulted on what I had written here, and I consulted him on this name, and he had a lot of suggestions for changing what I originally had, and I was pretty attached to that. As soon as I get something, I think, well, that's good. You know, then it's hard. I don't change it very easily, but I did ask him, and I know he's an excellent word crafter, and so he started working on it, and he'd say, well, I think this I don't understand this word, and so on. So it eventually came to this, and it got a little bit longer because of Bradley, but that's because that was in order to make it clear. One thing that changed was that I do recall very well was the word introduced. The name of this site is International Day of Commemoration in Honor of the Revisionists. That's necessary. Who introduced sanity to the Auschwitz death camp narrative? Well, we say, I think I had who brought sanity. Now, I don't know if he came up with the word sanity. I may have said something else. No, I did because I had that because it was from Carlo Mantogno's book, The Case for Sanity. And I kind of started with that idea, which is all about Auschwitz. It's called Auschwitz, The Case for Sanity. And so that's what I was going to use for here. And so that was all right. But he didn't think brought was, he suggested something, and then he suggested introduced. And I thought, introduced? You know, this is really getting involved here. I didn't like that. But after I thought about it for a while, I thought they was right. You know, that's what they did. They didn't just bring sanity, which I could say that. But they actually introduced it into the Holocaust narrative. And then he always thought it should be death camp narrative, the Auschwitz death camp narrative. So I finally agreed with that he was right about that, and so that got added because the whole idea to get across to people, and this is a site that hopefully reaches people that aren't just in, you know, already convinced, which is highly unlikely, but that's what it wants to do, because it's what it presents is for people to consider some other points of view and consider some evidence and so on. And so the what's wrong about Auschwitz is that it's called a death camp. That's the main thing. Because it was a camp, and it was a concentration camp, and it was a labor camp, and there was three parts to it, and it's very, very complex in itself, but it was not a death camp. So So that's the reason for the name, and I don't have any intention of changing it anymore. I'm going to leave it. And now, as to why, another thing about that people bring up to me a lot and have written, saying, why don't you write about this? Why don't you write about that? It's always about other camps. Now, the reason that this website is only about somewhat limited is because it's only about Auschwitz-Birkenau, and it's intended to be only about that. As you can see at the heading of it, the banner, if you can tell from that it has a map, actually a Google map image of the three camps, Birkenau, Auschwitz, and Monowitz, and how they relate to one another, which I thought was important to inform people who thought that maybe really didn't understand them or really thought they were very close together and how they're separated. So I think that's good. And then there's a picture of, I can't get it to change now. I think I had my arrow on it. There's a picture, here it is, of the wide one of the unloading out of a train. And this is what I think Auschwitz should be understood as. Then there's the picture gets smaller, and you see more of the foreground of it. And then we have another little map showing what the whole area was all about. And I thought this was a very informative way of getting people to understand the thing geographically, which most people are just as geographically challenged as I am. So that tells you right there. And this picture of the unloading is indicative that this is as bad as it got there, you know, for the most part. I mean, this is the people were transported there in these railroad cars. Yes, but you can see as they're getting off here that they look okay. It doesn't look like they're, you know, dying or, you know, totally skeletons or anything. They came through the trip not that bad. And there's somebody standing there, a German, for the Germans, standing there helping people get out of the, and they're just milling about. What they're doing is they're being relocated, and yeah, they were being brought to into these labor camps, and they were going to be moved to any number of other labor camps. That's all true, and that's the story of Auschwitz-Birkenau. So the reason that now, this letter that I got from J.A., this comment that I just posted today that he sent a couple weeks ago, he says, it's very nice, you know, he says, this wonderful site is a huge step forward in understanding what really happened in the camps. Might I suggest future editions that would help others come to grips with this alleged fraud? And the first one is, the biggest counter argument is but the photos show. In quotes. Perhaps a tab should be added which shows the photos and provides a real concise analysis of what is depicted, including the crude photoshopping attempts and outright mislabeling and etc. I think he's right. I think that's a very good idea, and I think I am going to make an effort to add a photo page, misleading photo page, fraudulent photos. But they will all be about Auschwitz-Birkenau. They won't be anything else for the reasons that I just gave and I'm going to give more of. Then he added some more suggestions, but they all would, they wouldn't all, but one was to include a link to the Red Cross 3-volume report of German internment camps. That doesn't have, it's not particularly only to do with Auschwitz. Then questions that revisionists have about the camps, short list. Well, I was gonna put in, I had an idea for something else I never got around to. I'll have to pull that up again. And then running a list of debunked things and lists of recanting Nuremberg witnesses and fraudulent books. So that's all general Holocaust. And a lot of people, a lot of sites do that. I don't think there's anything new to it. I don't think we all have to do the same thing. And so if you go to one, you've gone to all or something. Anyway, he ends up saying, keep up the great work. The truth always rises to the top. So I want to thank him for that. But I want to explain why people write to me and say, you know, why don't you include something about the Treblinka thing? Why don't you include this? And how about this video? Well, you know, it's not one that's about Auschwitz-Birkenau. It's about other camps. And I tell them why, if I can. But I want to reiterate here that this site is in response to Auschwitz only. And because, as I said, that's what the International Day of Commemoration is about. Also, that thing that they hold, that event they hold at the AB Memorial in Poland is basically they have to stick with Auschwitz, and they're visiting. They're going around the camp, you know, that's not a camp; it's a memorial museum. But they're going around there and looking at things and talking about it. It's all about that camp only. And I think that if you try to put everything about the Holocaust on a site, unless you've got it really well organized and you've got a particular, you know, point of view, which a lot of them do, particularly like Eric Hunt's Holocaust Hoax Museum is very well organized. But if I'm not putting my full attention on this site, nor is anybody else. So this was meant to be a simple site with a simple message to begin with. You know, we can't overload people with a little bit of everything. And I think that's when people get confused about the Holocaust. If you don't mind my adding this here, which is not about, well, in a sense it is about my anniversary, so all of this is. If you start talking about every aspect of the Holocaust, then, boy, people just, they get this confused with that, or they pick apart one thing, they go off somewhere else. My intention here was to present the truth about Auschwitz-Birkenau in a simple and way that people cannot refute, in a way that's so convincing that it wins people over. At least it opens up their mind if they would read it or look through it carefully enough. That's the idea. That's why it's organized the way it is. While it's good to always put new things and to have a lot of stuff for people to look at, once they've looked at everything already once, what I intend to do now with this is to think about how to maybe reorganize it. I like the way I organized it, even though some people like Guillermo Rudolph disagreed with me, because it's not the way he would do it. He would, you know, have sections for everything, and then he'd have table of contents like thing, and like more like Kodo is, where you've got all this information, you go from here, and you finally get to the page. But I wanted it to be just here's this part of it. What about religion at the Auschwitz Birkenau? What about the gas chambers? What about having a plan? All these things. What was Auschwitz? Well, some of this gets a little bit general for for the whole thing. But anyway, that was the idea, that everything should relate to Auschwitz, and that if you can prove, if you can make people question Auschwitz as being what they say it was, then it certainly, you can't then say, well, okay, nothing happened at Auschwitz. Let's see, where else did it happen? You really can't do that, because it just undermines the whole Holocaust. And I think we've tended lately to forget about Auschwitz, because Auschwitz, the revisionists have done such a great job of showing what Auschwitz really was, and of showing the lies of the Holocaust historians, that they have moved elsewhere and trying to make their case elsewhere. They don't want to talk about this anymore. And yet this commemoration day is set on this day that puts the focus there. And that's why I think it's good to do the same, put the focus here and try to force something you never get from them, answers. Try to force these questions and the lack of answers, you might say, and what the truth is about it. So I'd like to make this site more relevant and have people continue to come here, but it's kind of hard to do. Now, the other thing that Guillermo Rudolph helped me with was the revisionists. And I was going to have all the revisionists, but he said if you do that, you'll have there'll be so many, and you're going to forget a lot of them. And they're not all going to be like, you know, I don't know if you said this, but I'm just thinking this, they're not all going to be of equal importance either. So he said, thought I should do, since it's a memorial thing, or the actual one is, it's a commemoration in honor of those who have passed. He said, do the ones who passed on. And he had to help me with those because I didn't know them all, but I think that was a great idea. And I don't know if any revisionists have passed on this year. I haven't heard of any. I don't know of any. So I don't know if we'll have any names added. Well, I hope not. But eventually there will be names added. Now, to go on with this. Okay, I did all that. I did this. Oh, so now then on the front page of January27.org, underneath the names of the revisionists and how they were persecuted, I wrote something that I just wanted to stick in there at the time because I had heard that phrase. But it's turned out to be really relevant in light of this blog post or this article that recent article that Robert Forison has written. I assume he's written it recently. At least it was posted at his site on August 25th, which was only a month ago. But I said that it's a sad fact that in our societies, it is not acknowledged that revisionists have rights too. And that is so true. It is so true that actually everybody's supposed to have rights, but revisionists do not have rights. They have no rights. And in this, what Robert Forison wrote about his experiences at the hands of this Jew named Gregory Celli, Chelli, who has several aliases, and the inaction of the police in doing anything about it, and what he calls Jewish terrorism. And I'm just going to read part of this, certain sentences, and I think it'll get the story across as to just how bad it is, and will take me into another topic. And that's residing, he says, it seems at times, in his native Paris, at other times somewhere in Romania, and sometimes in Israel. And 30-year-old French Israeli Gregory Celli is by means of the internet making the life of men and women whom he considers anti-Semitic miserable. He sets up provocations in the course of which he makes the police service look ridiculous. So far, he seems to have enjoyed an impunity comparable, proportionately speaking, to that of the state of Israel itself. Up till now, he said, Alain Soral and Dieudonné, that French comedian, Negro French comedian, and their families have been among his best known targets. And he says, in our turn, we, my wife and I, along with some members of our family, have had to endure his provocations. I am 85, and my wife, who is nearly 83, is in poor health. Her eyesight is diminishing. She is prone to falls and so on. He says he has to be by her side most of the time, and if he's not, then somebody has to call in somebody else to do so because she can't be alone. And yet, from March 8th, 2012, so we're talking about 2 years ago in 2012, if not before, and for as long as he was able to call to phone us at our old number, they just finally got a new number, this Chelly assailed us with 100 calls of insults, abuse, threats, including death threats, and I stress this point, on some of these occasions committed numerous actual assaults, details of which will be seen below. He has gone on making fun with impunity of the French police in general and its anti-violent crime sections, known as BAC, in particular, something that costs the taxpayer dearly, this anti-crime section, BAC. The taxpayers pay for it, he says. The police register our complaints, but nothing or almost nothing comes of it, of them. Now, I'm going to use some bad language here because he gives examples. And what I love about Robert Faurisson, among other things, but yeah, this kind of takes in the whole thing, is that he never fails to say what needs to be said, and he never fails to tell the truth about what's going on in things that other people would, so many other people would say, well, I don't really want to talk about this. I think it's better not to talk about this. And they, you know, they won't go, but he will report everything. And if he thinks a person in the movement, in amongst revisionists or outside of revisionists or in amongst the Holocaust historians, if he thinks they need some criticism or some commenting on what they're saying or doing, he will do it. He's not afraid. He's never shy about these things. And he says somewhere in here, I don't know if it's part of what I've got highlighted, but he says that he has never been timid. One thing he's never been is timid. And that's the truth. He's not a masochist. He's not looking for trouble. But he's just not too timid, you know, to say what he thinks should be said. And I think these things should be said, too. I'm very glad he wrote this. And in, you know, and this was translated into English so that all of us can read it and get an example of what goes on. We need these examples. So here's the first one. There are recordings that, and he puts them on the internet. But he calls up his wife, Mrs. Faurisson, and says, has said, bitch, I shit on you. I piss on you. I enjoy seeing your husband's smashed head. I something you. Too bad to say, I guess. I'm going to make your life impossible. I'm going to call your neighbors. Then he says some more. Then the police say, well, you know, he gives some history of his experience with the police when he was assaulted, and the police told him not to go places if it was dangerous for him, and to stay home, or they're not his bodyguards, and stuff like that he got from the police for, you know, being actually physically attacked. Now, he says, not once was any of my attackers or any of the organizers of the assaults arrested in the attacks made on him personally. So getting back to these phone calls, he says that I lodged my first complaint against Chelly for telephone harassment and assault at Vichy Police Station. He lives in the city called Vichy in France. Vichy Police Station on March 9, 2012. And he says, I specified that the individual had also phoned two of my neighbors in the middle of the previous night, telling the first that there was a gas leak in my house and that he must go and inform me of it. And the neighbor believed it was in a state of panic and rushed over to his house to tell him that. And then he, this Chelly said to this other neighbor that he called, he told him that Farisong was a terrorist. They were both ready to talk to the police about, you know, the phone calls. But Farisong says that the police never looked them up, never asked them anything. Now, this is where this comes in under revisionists have rights too, and why we find everywhere revisionists don't have, are not considered to have any rights the way that other people do. So he says on the next day, March 10th, 2012, after that after that neighbor thing, he says the historian Paul Eric Blanrue, whom I knew to be remarkably knowledgeable on the subject of Jewish activism, revealed Gregory Chelly's identity to me and supplied me with a wealth of information about him, which I then shared with the police. On the next day, Sunday, March 11th, then his grandson phoned him and told him that he had orders from his father. They lived nearby, near Vichy, but not in Vichy, that they were not able to come visit him any longer because now their father had received a phone call from this Chelly and telling him that someone was going to set fire to his house. And the grandson's father, Robert Farisong's son, has had a lot of trouble because of what Robert Farisong does as a revisionist. And a lot of trouble has fallen onto him, and he's sick of it. And he's very unhappy with it. He kind of thinks it's ruined his life. And he said things like, you know, he said negative things about his father because it's of he wishes he was, you know, because it's harming him so much. But it doesn't stop Robert Farisong. He says, I understand and forgive him. He forgives him. He's not happy with what's happening, but he cannot, he's the kind of person, he cannot stop speaking up for the truth in an area that he's begun in and he's done so much in. Now, he goes on about these phone calls. He says this Chelly kept up his assaults on the telephone. And here's what he says to his wife, or this is to him, I guess, son of a whore, son of a whore, son of a whore. We'll get you one day. We're waiting for you to come to Paris to see Dudonnet, Sorrel. You're worth shit. And he contacted the police about this, and he asked when his neighbors who had witnessed that thing were going to be called in to give their story. And they tell him, oh, they'll be called, but he says, in fact, they never were called. He made out a second report, and it was signed by the police commissioner, and yet no action followed. On March 19th, he says, I obtained an interview with he's got a long Polish name, of the Vichy police station. He seemed amiable and interested, but there were still no follow-up on the case. On March 21st, I wrote to him, to no avail. Throughout the month of May at the station, I would speak 4 times with Major Gay, that's the police commissioner, I think, something like that. And but he made strange objections about YouTube videos and said that there's no way we don't have any control over YouTube videos. That's the best he got out of them. Then on June 30th, Chelly got his wife on the phone and told her, we're going to put ground glass in your blank, whatever that word is. It's too bad to use, I guess. And on January 9th, the thug, pretending to be a doctor, called and announced to Robert Farisong, this is Chabanet Charente Hospital. Your wife is dead. This kind of childish stuff. Yes, it seems childish, but you're talking about a man who's been through a lot. He's 85, his wife is 83, and he's not in great health, but she's in worse health, and doing this kind of thing. It is absolutely some kind of a criminal offense. I don't know if it would be a misdemeanor or what it would be, but it's harassment. And not provocated, you know, not provoked either by the forest zones. But you know how it is. They seem to think that if you're a revisionist, you deserve everything you get. Or they just don't have anyone who will support going after Jews. So he says in February 2013, the harassment continued. And, there's a lot of stuff I'm going to pass by here because it's just more stuff that showing their inaction of the police. And he finally got to see this commander with the Polish name on February 21st, and he informed him as though they had done a great thing. They've got his phone number. They've got Chelly's phone number. But they didn't reveal the number to Forison, and he does not know what action they took, if any. A new complaint was lodged. Okay, new calls, new insults on March 14th. Even though they got his phone number, he's still calling. And he says, you're still alive. So there, rotter, old fossil, old fossil, old fossil. Now, I want to say here, this is the kind of thing, this very kind of talk that these people who write comments, who on pro-white websites, who are supposed to be all these anti-Semites on there, you know, who are against Jews, they write like this about me. Not everybody, but I mean, there's always been a crowd of them who write exactly this same way about me, calling me an old hag, an old maid, an old this and all that. And Rodney Martin's friends and folks wrote about me this way too, when they couldn't think of anything else to defend them, defend themselves with. They just came out with stuff like this. And this is the kind of thing that Jews say. And, you know, it is. This is what they come up with, just insults of this type. If you're old, they'll focus on how old and decrepit you are, and are you going to die, and things like that, and how worthless you are. If you're not old, they'll come up with something different. But and this is just what these people do, and they do it on Daily Stormer, and they did it on that Grism Blogspot when they had my programs on there. And that it's just, to me it tells me that these people are Jews doing this. They're trolling, Jews trolling. But nobody ever stops them on these sites. Everybody let that go. Certainly, at Daily Stormer, they let it go. Because if they think they do it, if they don't like the person for whatever reason who it's being said about. So that's a comment that belongs in talking about our movement. But I threw that in here. So on April 3rd, the guy calls and says, I'll go and piss on your grave, son of shit. Your daughter, your son divorced you, disowned you. I'm sorry, your son disowned you like a dog. Yeah, they like to say things like that too. If you have any enemy amongst your own type there, or own kind, they'll bring that up and say, see, nobody likes you. Then he goes on to say, your wife sells her paintings, whatever that means. I'm Gregory Chelly. I called your neighbor for the gas leak. I'll make YouTube videos. So at this point, now see, they got his phone number, but on April 3rd he was still calling. And this, he was told about how they got his phone number on February. Well, that's not so much February. No, March. March is in between, right? So Farson says he ended up changing his phone number, which was considerable nuisance for him, but he did it, and then they no longer received these have no longer been receiving these calls. But the situation would suddenly worsen, and he talks about his long experience with Jewish attacks, and he says he had this case against someone. I don't want to go into all the details. But he says, he says that for many French judges, my opponents are automatically in good faith. Because there was this 207, someone had said on television that he called him a falsifier of history. And this was a Jew and was a person associated with LICRA, that anti-racist organization, a lawyer for them. And Faurisson took him to court. Faurisson's taken a number of people to court. This man was not able to prove his assertion that Faurisson was a falsifier of history. And he didn't. And so actually, Faurisson won the case, or should have won the case. He said that never in his life has he ever been found guilty of distorting or falsifying anything whatsoever. And the court had to take note of the fact that Badinter, that was this man's name, Badinter had failed to offer the proof, had failed in his offer of proof, but that he had acted in good faith. And so, even though in any other case, Faurisson won the case, he lost the case. He lost the suit, and he had to pay 5,000 euros to this, what he called my extremely rich good faith slanderer. That in the court there, the judge could say, well, you know, he's wrong about that, but he didn't act in bad faith. He believed it. He thought it was true. So therefore, he's not guilty. And then on top of that, Faurisson had to pay this man's legal fees because Faurisson brought the suit. I think that's just beyond. Of course, there's worse things than 5,000 euros, but still, just insanity. And he said that the year before, he's just saying that this historian Pierre Vidal Naquet, he's a well-known Holocauster. And Faurisson calls him the most worthless of my opponents. He wrote on a website that if I had got my hands on Faurisson, I would not have hesitated to strangle him. Well, Faurisson said he knew that he could be fined for that, but he was not able to prosecute him at the time because he was so overloaded with other problems and cases and so on, and he just didn't have the money to do it. So he got away with that. But then he says, my wife is distraught. She can no longer sleep. Personally, I refuse to dwell too long on the consequences of what I call the Jewish torture. But he says that he doesn't sleep well himself, that he cries out in his sleep when he's having nightmares. And but in public, you know, he laughs and smiles. But what he's saying is that it takes a big toll on him, all this harassment, persecution, all this hatefulness. And he says, I've learned that my new file is in the hands of Major Gay, this police commissioner. All these complaints he's been filing with the police. And he says, the good man has done nothing in the past. He will do nothing in the future. Then finally, one thing that he does that I'm going to bring up is that he says, to those interested in the eternal Jewish question, for which I personally am not at all impassioned, this is, I recommend the writings of Erv Rissen. For my part, he says, I have focused my attention on the religion of the Holocaust, or the Shoah, a religion with historical pretensions, which is, of course, Jewish, but which reigns throughout the Western world among both the Jews and the Goyim, or Gentiles. It is in crisis. Too many historians have ended up showing the fallacious nature of the allegations of that alleged tribunal, in which, at Nuremberg, the victors in coalition allowed themselves to try an enemy whom they had crushed and whom they held at their mercy in the worst conditions. This religion has given itself an official character in many democratic countries, including France. Its allegations regarding history have acquired the force of law. Well, let me say that while I agree that revisionists should work at the evidence of the Holocaust, and they should not be focused on Jews per se. They should be working the way they do work in a scientific and objective manner, and they should be, and they've been very, very successful with this. But I also say, Forreston feels very strongly that that this thing has to be crushed, but he seems to think that by showing people what it's like, and in this case he felt he needed to talk about the harassment that he had been receiving to get wake some people up, that, you know, we have a duty to resist this great, he calls it, imposture of modern times, the most gigantic imposture of modern times, and it's especially because it's protected by the police, the judges, and the prison guards. So well protected, but he says we have to keep going about it in a way of proving that it didn't happen it didn't happen at all. Something happened, but not that. So, okay, I agree that's probably correct for a working revisionist like him and other revisionists, because they don't want their work to be stained by any kind of way that the opposition could show, or the Holocaustists could show that they're doing it because they don't like Jews. They're doing it for anti-Semitic reasons. Well, they're accused of that anyway, but they don't want to give them any place to that they don't want to give any of those opportunities to them. But the fact of the matter is, boy, I've got a lot I could say yet, and I was going to invite phone callers, and if somebody really wants to call, if you want to call, you're welcome to call. I don't mean that, say it that way. You're welcome to call. The number is 323-642-1206. Okay? The fact is that in my mind, in my understanding, Forreston is highlighting here the single most important issue facing us. And I don't mean just revisionists, Holocaust revisionists, but all of us in the so-called truth movement. I'm calling it that today, but I didn't get to talk about my history. I might do that yet. So that is the criminal behavior of Jews among us. All right? This is the crux of it. The fact that Jews have privileges and we don't, and that most white people are not aware of this. And if you would tell them, they would not want to listen to you, or they would deny it. They say, "Well, give me an example. Well, when has it happened to you?" I was talking to my sister-in-law two nights ago, and I don't talk to her very often, but it just so happened at this time. And we didn't get into this much because right away she said, I was talking about racial issues, white racial issues. And she said, "You better stay away from that stuff." She says, "You're going to get in trouble with that stuff." I said, I just laughed because I'm going to get in trouble. I'm probably already in trouble. But she's the kind of person who will accept me as believing anything I want to believe. But she doesn't want to hear too much about it, and she wouldn't even consider it. And she's satisfied with the way things are, and she's not a closed-minded person, but yet she still is closed-minded about that. I mean, she's not interested. She doesn't want to hear about it, and that's the way most people are. You see, that's the way the majority of people that are out there are. They're not going to do anything that's going to rock the boat or cause them to look different or be a problem. And they will always say, well, give me an example of what actually happened to you. Well, Robert Forsong has done this here. He's given an example of what's happened to him. But most of us, we don't have any personal experience with being with any of this, with being not given our legal rights or one thing or another. But we know people who have, and we can point to them, but that's not good enough for these people. They say, well, they did this, they did that, you know, but you don't have a problem, so why are you complaining? So the question is how best to do that, because I think that the fact that Jews are rarely punished for their crimes shows that that Jews are in rulership position, and I think this is the thing to show. Too many anti-Semitic sites are kind of crude, rude, and way overdone, and the people who are already believers in this enjoy them, but they don't convince anybody else. They don't reach people. I think we have to reach people with being able to show in detail and clearly the advantages that Jews have at the expense of non-Jews and the rest of us, and how long this has been going on, and how it goes on. It's omnipresent in all of our countries, and see if there's one more thing I need to say about that. And how wrong this is, and how harmful it is. I forgot to use the word harm. And that in this way, they harm us. And we need to get this across to people. And we're not going to get it across by showing caricatures of Jew faces and so on, and ugly things like that. I'm not against that personally myself, but I just think that we don't have enough of the other, and we need lots of it. I mean, we don't just need a few websites. We need lots of attention on this issue. And I think this is the way to show people that Jews are harmful, by simply pointing out all the harm that they're doing. And this is where the focus should be. And going right along with this then is the other most serious problem, which can be seen as the most serious problem, but it actually comes from the first one, is the immigration problem and the invasion of our countries, because eventually they're already starting to take over the lawmaking powers of the legislatures. In fact, they already control this. The whole multicultural belief system controls all the lawmaking, state and national, and the lawmakers. So it won't be long as this progresses, we won't recognize our nation or our land, and we won't be able to do anything about it, just as Robert Forsong cannot do anything about this harassment he's receiving, that any normal citizen, if they're getting it from any other normal citizen, French person, I guess, that didn't have to do with, if they wasn't a Holocaust revisionist, would be able to get some satisfaction from the police, but not him. And this is the way it's going to become for all of us, where we don't have our rights. We don't have any rights anymore. And we hardly have rights now, truthfully, if we would want to go up against some of these people. So, race mixing is secondary to this, I've realized, because the majority of our people resist mixing with other races, really. And still, for the most part, you find all those situations and then places like the Stormer show up, you know, show pictures of every one of them. Yeah, it's more than you'd like, but it's not so common at this point. So most of us don't do that. But the greatest danger remains our loss of sovereignty, our loss of control of our lands, our governments, the taxpayer money, where that money is going, and the police forces, the military, etc. You know, we become voiceless, powerless, and I don't have a need to go look for help for myself, so I don't experience that. But I know it would be there if I did try, and I was going up against certain powers or peoples, and if I didn't have any means for myself and so on, well then, you know, I would experience how weak I was as a white person. Whereas in the early part of my life, I used to think about how secure I was and how strong I felt as being, you know, a white person in America. You know, how privileged I was. That's what you get from that. But I didn't think I didn't deserve it. You know, I just thought I was happy about it. Well, it's not there anymore. Now, let's see here. I was hurrying so I could get back to this thing, and I'm not sure what it was. If anyone has any thoughts that they want to express, you're very welcome to do so. To call in, the number is 323-642-1206. I'm thinking that I'm not going to have a show on Monday because I have a lot of things that need to be taken care of. And I did this show. I would have probably skipped today, but since it fell on the 27th, I did this show today, and but I'm probably going to need to prepare for a show on Monday. So unless something comes up or something easy or something big, and I do have one, but right now I think I'm not planning on doing one. I don't want to move into this other material, so I want to stay with the website topic, and I need to. Where should I go? Nobody's calling, and I thought I skipped something, but I can't remember what it was. That's terrible. Let's see here. Well, all right. I think that is pretty much it. So what's coming up is that I want to pay more attention to, once again, during this next couple of months, to revisionism and to working on how to make some parts of that more effective. But also I have some good programs, some good guests lined up as soon as they get their stuff together. So there will be some of that too. Oh, I know what I was going to go to. Back to January27th.org. I passed by this so I would get everything in and also be able to take some calls, but on the front page of January27th.org is a statement under where it says revisionists have rights too, is an article by Robert Faurisson. Again, this is a lot about Robert here, and in which he discusses how the universal ban on revisionism was passed by the United Nations. Here again, he is the one who makes sure that this kind of thing is written about and this kind of thing is known. And I appreciate it very much. When I saw this, I thought this is just perfect for the front page of this website, because he explains in here how it was the Israeli delegation to the UN that actually wrote this a resolution to commemorate the victims of the Holocaust on January 27th and make that the International Day of Commemoration in memory of the victims of the Holocaust. And he says how this came about in the same way they bring everything about in by sleight of hand, you know, that that they wrote up this resolution and presented it to the whatever committee they would present it to, or the, and the president of the General Assembly at this time in I must have it somewhere. Okay, but anyway, they got this general. I'm sorry, folks. I'm right here at it again. I keep moving around. This president of the General Assembly, the Swede Jan Eliasson. However you pronounce that, I'm not sure. He was willing to go along with them. And he knew what was in the resolution, but not everybody, people, it had been passed out, I suppose, but people don't read this stuff too carefully. And what he managed to do was on a November 1st, was to just orally ask the assembly whether anybody was opposed to the resolution for commemorating the Holocaust. Well, when you ask people to raise their hand in the General Assembly, if they're opposed to a resolution commemorating the Holocaust, nobody wants to raise their hand, considering the nature of the beast here. So no hands were raised. So then he went from there to saying that the resolution was thereby adopted, and nobody objected to that. There was no real vote taken. It was a raising of the hands thing, and for something that turned out to be this important, the people could have thought it wasn't very important. So okay, we're going to have a resolution to commemorate the victims of the Holocaust. That's innocent enough, right? But included in this resolution was text that provided for the condemnation of any form of Holocaust revisionism. So it wasn't just commemorating the victims, but it was condemning Holocaust revisionism. And the United States approved the draft of this itself, because of its importance. It was shown to them. And even though it went against, as Forreston makes out the argument, the First Amendment in the United States, but they approved of it anyway, and he says it was remarkable that even the Arab and Muslim countries accepted this resolution, but they did, and so nobody wanted to go against it, so therefore it became what you would call an official resolution of the United Nations. But as Forreston says, it doesn't carry any political and especially any juridical weight. they can't pass a law like that or anything. It's not a law. It's just a resolution saying that they're for this and they're against something. They're against they're for the Holocaust of memorial and they're against revisionism. But he says that it carries some weight because it can add to difficulties as regards border and airport police staying in certain countries, revisionists, and issuing of visas and so on, because it has condemned Holocaust revisionism, which is which they also say in the beginning is a historical event, and the resolution rejects any denial of the Holocaust as a historical event, either in full or part. So they call it a historical event, and yet at the same time they say that you can't discuss it or have different opinions about it, or write that it may, you know, any question, you can't question it. So it's all very crazy. If there was any real law to follow or any real law that you could appeal to, you could make some progress against these things. But the reason I say that it's all about explaining to people what the Jew, I just hate to just call them the Jews. You know, I just like to think of something else than to just say the Jews. But what this Jewish, what do I always call it, the world Jewry, the Jewish power structure is doing to us, and how much harm they're doing, how they're absolutely destroying our nations and our nation states and our national life and our rights and our privileges and our laws and everything else. And this is what we have to get across. I know people think they're working at that, and I'm not saying they're not. They are working at that, but I don't think it's getting through to people. I mentioned my sister-in-law, and she's just typical. Of course, she's a typical Democrat, so, you know, maybe some Republicans are better. But even so, even people within the so-called movement want to protect Jews. And now even Robert Faurisson has this phrase, did I use it, of talking about the Jewish Jews and as distinct from the Jews, because I can understand people not wanting to just say the Jews, you know, and like big broad brush. And it sounds so bad, too, to average people, of course. It does. Oh, the Jews. Oh, you always blame everything on the Jews. Talk about this. You know, you're nuts. So you don't want to say that. But Faurisson is wrong to think that there's Jewish Jews and then other Jews that are okay. As long as we actually think that there's Jews that are okay. Oops, there's a phone call. Sorry, I just turned up back to my studio and saw it. I hope you haven't been waiting too long. This is from 424. Hello there.
Hello?
Yes. Hi, Don.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I hear you now.
Yeah, I wanted to call and say congratulations on your third year of your website. I had not seen the January 27 website before, but I went over there, and it's pretty good. I like the whole theme of it and everything, and I would like to see more, you know, more traffic go to that site. In the last couple of years, there's been, you know, some controversy over whether the Holocaust is, you know, is even something we should spend time on, or you know, what is the relevance mm-hmm. of it to the struggle for white survival? And of course, we have the very famous Mark Weber denunciation of any further activity in that direction. He's concluded that it's futile and, you know, forget about it, and people are going to call you names if you go in that direction. We had I think the truth is important, whether he does or not, and I think the fact that the Holocaust has been used for so long as a club to beat us into submission shows that it, A, is extremely important, and B, there is a huge measure of vulnerability to the Holocaust legend. And here in Southern California, we saw an example of that within the last couple of years. Rialto is a small community just about 60 miles east of metropolitan Los Angeles. I think it's actually in San Bernardino County, but it's a small school district, and they had an assignment. 2008 grade students were assigned essays as part of a critical thinking project, and I guess the theme was, was the Holocaust really real, or was it a public relations stunt? I'm going from memory on this. In any event, there was, in 2008, grade students wrote handwritten essays about it, and about 50 of them came down pretty strongly in favor of the position that the Holocaust was exaggerated, that it was a public relations stunt designed to acquire, you know, financial and political power for the Jews. And this thing came about, and there's a huge eruption out here, and you had the newspapers went through a Freedom of Information Act thing, and they actually got copies of the essays, although the names were redacted. And there was even, you know, all these rabbis went out here, and they went to the school board meeting, and the Jewish Legislative Caucus in the California State Legislature, I didn't even know we had one, but we do. And they got into the act, and they reviewed it, and they came away with the thinking that this was a very, very insidious and dangerous thing. And they, there was a big school board meeting, and I guess all these rabbis went out there to hyperventilate and, you know, go through their usual thing. And they're going to, the school is going to have to go through its usual supplication. But there were a couple of interesting aspects to me, and the first aspect is how terrified these people are. You know, 50 13-year-olds questioned the Jewish version of the history of World War II, and this is an earth-shaking event, and all these people are out here, you know, wringing their hands and clutching their pearls and hyperventilating. I think this shows the real vulnerability these people have. And moreover, there's kind of a mystical, spiritual aspect to the Holocaust, and one of the people who was quoted in the local press said, this was a Jewish rabbi or a Jewish lawyer, I forget which, he said, it is outrageous that they challenged the factual aspect of this event. And of course, when this is supposedly an historical event, and when something on a factual assertion cannot be challenged, is not subject to be examined by speech and reason and the other methods of scientific inquiry, what do we call it? We call it something that is accepted on faith. And something that accepted on faith is per se within the definition of a religion. So what happened to the wall of separation between church and state that says children can't sing Christmas carols, but Jews can promulgate their own version of history of World War II, which is based on faith.
John, yeah, what happened is that they say it's not a religion, it's a historical event, and they're teaching history. That's what happened.
Yeah, but you see, historical events are not accepted on faith. Historical events are not surrounded by intellectual Berlin walls.
Sure, well, we know all that, but you have to argue that out with the people who are in charge, and that they are not going to go along with you, even if it's true, as Robert Forsan's experience and many others have shown. We've got the truth on our side. We've got the rights, and they know it. They absolutely know it. And that's why they're scared, but they've still got the power. And they don't like it to be shown that, I don't know. I don't really know if their motivations are what they say, if they're as scared as they act like they are. But the fact is that a lot of our people say, oh, they're ready to fall down. They're so scared. They're ready to crash down and make it seem like it's just going to happen on its own, you know, in another year or something. Whereas I always say that these people have they have so much power, and they also are thinking and working on this all the time. So they come back with all sorts of things. And why I think that revisionist work alone in disproving that this what they say happened could have happened, that alone will not do it. While it does need to be continued to be, they need to continue doing it. Revisionists, that's what revisionists do. you know, they're a historian. They work with history and facts and reality and science. That's what they should be doing. But there also needs to be the other education about the harm that Jews do, even like in what you're talking about here, in the sense of upholding falsehoods because they benefit them and them alone, things like that. I think that's the approach that needs many more people working on it. It's not that there aren't people doing that, but there's not enough. Are you following what I'm saying here?
Yes, I am. The significance of the Holocaust, whether it's an actual event or simply something, a mystical allegation that has to be accepted on faith, it is the basis of an international cartel that produces a multi-billion dollar income stream from taxes, movie royalties, book royalties, and it is the source of an enormous amount of political and economic power. And that is the significance of the Holocaust.
There you go. That's good. Yeah, that's real good.
That is really the significance of the Holocaust. It's an industry. And I think we have as much right to challenge that industry as we do to challenge the automobile industry or the tobacco industry or any other industry. I mean, there's only one other industry I can think of in the history of the United States that has attempted to suppress and put in jail people who criticized that institution and used physical oppression as a means of silencing people who challenged the income stream that came from that institution, and that was slavery. If you criticized slavery in the Old South, you could be put in jail for inciting murder, incredibly enough, because it was possible that these people would rise up and claim their freedom and kill their masters. But you see, slave owners tried to protect their income stream from slavery by silencing people who criticized it in the same way that the Holocaust entrepreneurs today are protecting their income stream by silencing people who attack the factual and moral basis on which that of the narrative that provides the basis for that income stream. So there definitely is a political and a financial interest here, and you're quite right about that. That's an angle that really needs to be emphasized more.
Yeah, more. It's not that it isn't. But more, and maybe in a better way, more objective way, so that it doesn't appear that you hate you doing it because you don't like Jews. And
I
appear that way all the time, but I know that we need people who don't appear that way.
You see, one of the reasons I wanted to get to the element of blind faith as the basis of the allegation of the Holocaust narrative is the fact that we have the First Amendment in this country. We have the wall of separation, so-called wall of separation between church and state. And if you're going to teach something based on faith that can't be questioned by science and reason and modern tactics of evaluation, I think that opens the door to a very interesting lawsuit, which could be used to challenge constitutionally the teaching of a lot of this Holocaust stuff. I've often thought that the practice of public school children being bused off to the Wiesenthal Center here in Los Angeles, which is a Jewish religious shrine. Let's face it, most of these Holocaust memorials are nothing but Jewish religious shrines, that violates the First Amendment. But, of course, you need money to finance that kind of a lawsuit, and you need a client, you need a plaintiff, who would be willing to be a party to that kind of lawsuit. But I think it would be very interesting, most especially here in California, which is within the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal, which has taken a very hostile attitude to the injection of religion into any aspect of public education. So I think that would be a hell of an interesting lawsuit.
Well, it would be. Find somebody to do it. I was trying to get some interest in that, in finding lawyers who would bring a suit for a Holocaust education in the schools and so on, and that's very hard to do. And then I've been talking about Matt Hale, who became a lawyer, and then they got him in maximum security for 40 years real quick. They don't want lawyers working on our side. But in any case, Eric Hunt is the one who is always interested in somebody starting a lawsuit. But I don't know. You're not going to Are you prepared to do that for a client like, say, myself? Or, you know, I mean, it wouldn't necessarily fit, let's just say myself. If I were to, or if would if we would try to raise money, you know, and then, but you wouldn't get rich on it, but would you bring a suit like that? And you're going to probably tell
me you're not that kind of a lawyer. I would have to see. In fact, I've given some thought to following up on the Rialto thing. Because under the laws of standing where you have taxpayer institutions, it might be that just any taxpayer in California or any resident of Rialto, separate and apart from a school child, could maintain such a lawsuit. There are ways to challenge that. There are ways to do it. Actually, I've been looking for somebody to do a civil rights lawsuit like that for, you know, the last 10 years or so. The problem is nobody really wants to do it. You know, their kids would be subject to retaliation, and you know they don't. But yeah, I've done some work up on it.
Yeah, if you're a party to what's going on, that makes a lot more sense than somebody from the outside. You know, like you said, a family member.
I just can't file a lawsuit because I don't like something they do. There has to be a client, so the client has to have standing.
Right.
The client has to have a legal relationship with the controversy. Or be involved in it in some fashion. So that's what you really have to do. But there's a lot of really, really juicy stuff, and I would like to get a transcript of this of the Board of Education meeting in Rialto. I had given some thought to attending that night, but I had another thing I had to deal with. But that's something that would be worth doing, worth thinking about. I don't know what your chances would be of winning it, but it would certainly be a way to draw attention to a lot of this kind of stuff. Because I think Jewish power, I think there are fissures beginning to appear in Jewish power, the Jewish monolith. It's beginning to crack, and there is more courage, more willingness to speak up openly against it. This guy Robert Ransdell in Kentucky. With his campaign, he's got these signs out that say "With Jews, we lose," and he's opened the door to a lot of discussion about it. So just being able to feel they have permission to even talk about the issue, that is something that is not to be sneezed at. I think that's a very important milestone when people feel that they can actually talk about Jews and challenge them the same way they challenge Protestants or Catholics or anybody else.
Well, that's what's important. I think that's very important. That's what I would hope to achieve in what I was talking about tonight. Don, we're running out of time here. I'm going to hear the 90-second warning very shortly. So you want to say your last words or sum up?
Well, I just want to say once again, congratulations, and to say keep up the good work. You're really making a difference out there. You've had a lot of persistence and gained a lot of ground.
Well, thank you. That's very kind of you. I know you're a good fan. I hope I'm kind of surprised you say you didn't see you didn't know about that January 27 site. So I have a link to it on my carolynyeager.net, a big one. So I hope you'll start going there some and read some of that material, because I think it's the best of the best of what is available.
I bookmarked it, and I certainly will.
Okay, and thank you, Don. Thanks, everybody, for listening today. I'm going to close out on this program now. So bye for now, and I might not be back on Monday, but I will be back.